Chapter 24. This experience. We have had a daily scramble for life, and when I say we, I include shoals of people. I have the impression that the only people who do not have to scramble are the veterans, the disciples who have been here before and know the ropes. I think they arrive about a week before the first opera and engage all the tables for the season. My tribe had tried all kinds of places, some outside of the town, a mile or two, and have captured only nibblings and odds and ends, never in any instance a complete and satisfying meal. Digestible? No, the reverse. These odds and ends are going to serve as souvenirs of Bereth, and in that regard their value is not to be overestimated. Photographs fade. Bric-a-brac gets lost, busts of Wagner get broken, but once you absorb a Bereth restaurant meal it is your possession, and your property until the time comes to embalm the rest of you. Some of these pilgrims here become, in effect, cabinets. Cabinets of souvenirs of Bereth. It is believed among scientists that you could examine the crop of a dead Bereth pilgrim anywhere in the earth, and tell where he came from. But I like this ballast. I think a Hermitage scrap-up at 8 in the evening, when all the famine breeders have been there, and laid in their mementos and gone, is the quietest thing you can lay on your keelson except gravel. Thursday. They keep two teams of singers in stock for the chief roles, and one of these is composed of the most renowned artists in the world, with Materna and Alvary in the lead. I suppose a double team is necessary. Doubtless a single team would die of exhaustion in a week, for all the plays last from 4 in the afternoon till 10 at night. Nearly all the labor falls upon the half-dozen head singers, and apparently they are required to furnish all the noise they can for the money. If they feel a soft, whispery, mysterious feeling, they are required to open out and let the public know it. Operas are given only on Sundays, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, with 3 days of ostensible rest per week, and two teams to do the 4 operas, but the ostensible rest is devoted largely to rehearsing. It is said that the off days are devoted to rehearsing from some time in the morning till 10 at night. Are there 2 orchestras also? It is quite likely, since there are 110 names in the orchestra list. Yesterday the opera was Tristan and Isolde. I have seen all sorts of audiences at theaters, operas, concerts, lectures, sermons, funerals, but none which was twin to the Wagner audience of Bereth for fixed and reverential attention. Absolute attention and petrified retention to the end of an act of the attitude assumed at the beginning of it. You detect no movement in the solid mass of heads and shoulders. You seem to sit with the dead in the gloom of a tomb. You know that they are being stirred to their profoundest depths, that there are times when they want to rise and wave handkerchiefs and shout their approbation, and times when tears are running down their faces, and it would be a relief to free their pent emotions in sobs or screams. Yet you hear not one utterance till the curtain swings together and the closing strains have slowly faded out and died. Then the dead rise with one impulse, and shake the building with their applause. Every seat is full in the first act, there is not a vacant one in the last. If a man would be conspicuous, let him come here and retire from the house in the midst of an act. It would make him celebrated. This audience reminds me of nothing I have ever seen, and of nothing I have read about except the city in the Arabian tale, where all the inhabitants have been turned to brass, and the traveler finds them after centuries mute, motionless, and still retaining the attitudes which they last knew in life. Here the Wagner audience dress as they please, and sit in the dark and worship in silence. At the Metropolitan in New York they sit in the glare, and wear their showiest harness, they hum airs, they squeak fans, they titter, and they gabble all the time. In some of the boxes the conversation and laughter are so loud, as to divide the attention of the house with the stage. In large measure the Metropolitan is a showcase for rich fashionables who are not trained in Wagnerian music, and have no reverence for it, but who like to promote art and show their clothes. Can that be an agreeable atmosphere to persons, in whom this music produces a sort of divine ecstasy, and to whom its creator is a very deity, his stage a temple, the works of his brain and hands consecrated things, and the partaking of them with eye and ear a sacred solemnity? Manifestly, no. Then, perhaps the temporary expatriation, the tedious traversing of seas and continents, the pilgrimage to Bharat stands explained. These devotees would worship in an atmosphere of devotion. It is only here that they can find it without fleck or blemish or any worldly pollution. In this remote village there are no sights to see, there is no newspaper to intrude the worries of the distant world, there is nothing going on, it is always Sunday. The pilgrim wends to his temple out of town, sits out his moving service, returns to his bed with his heart and soul, and his body exhausted by long hours of tremendous emotion, and he is in no fit condition to do anything but to lie torpid, and slowly gather back life and strength for the next service. This opera of Tristan and Isolde last night broke the hearts of all witnesses who were of the faith, and I know of some who have heard of many who could not sleep after it, but cried the night away. I feel strongly out of place here. Sometimes I feel like the sane person in a community of the mad. Sometimes I feel like the one blind man where all others see, the one groping savage in the college of the learned, and always, during service, I feel like a heretic in heaven. But by no means do I ever overlook or minify the fact that this is one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. I have never seen anything like this before. I have never seen anything so great and fine and real as this devotion. Friday. Yesterday's opera was merciful again. The others went, and they show marked advance in appreciation. But I went hunting for relics and reminders of the Margravin Wilhelmina, she of the imperishable memoirs. I am properly grateful to her for her unconscious satire upon monarchy and nobility, and therefore nothing which her hand touched or her eye looked upon is indifferent to me. I am her pilgrim. The rest of this multitude here are Wagner's. Tuesday. I have seen my last two operas. My season is ended, and we cross over into Bohemia this afternoon. I was supposing that my musical regeneration was accomplished and perfected, because I enjoyed both of these operas, singing and all, and, moreover, one of them was merciful, but the experts have disenchanted me. They say, singing, that wasn't singing. That was the wailing, screeching of third-rate obscurities, palmed off on us in the interest of economy. Well, I ought to have recognized the sign, the old sure sign, that has never failed me in matters of art. Whenever I enjoy anything in art it means that it is mighty poor. The private knowledge of this fact has saved me from going to pieces with enthusiasm in front of many and many a chromo. However, my base instinct does bring me profit sometimes. I was the only man out of 3,200 who got his money back on those two operas. William Dean Howells, is it true that the sun of a man's mentality touches noon at 40, and then begins to wane toward setting? Dr. Osler is charged with saying so. Maybe he said it, maybe he didn't. I don't know which it is. But if he said it, I can point him to a case which proves his rule. Proves it by being an exception to it. To this place I nominate Mr. Howells. I read his Venetian Days about 40 years ago. I compare it with his paper on Machiavelli in a late number of Harper, and I cannot find that his English has suffered any impairment. For 40 years his English has been to me a continual delight and astonishment. In the sustained exhibition of certain great qualities, clearness, compression, verbal exactness, and unforced and seemingly unconscious felicity of phrasing, he is, in my belief, without his peer in the English writing world. Sustained. I entrench myself behind that protecting word. There are others who exhibit those great qualities as greatly as he does, but only by interval distributions of rich moonlight, with stretches of veiled and dimmer landscape between, whereas Howells' moon sails cloudless skies all night and all the nights. In the matter of verbal exactness, Mr. Owls has no superior, I suppose. He seems to be almost always able to find that elusive and shifty grain of gold, the right word. Others have to put up with approximations, more or less frequently. He has better luck. To me, the others are miners working with the gold pan of necessity. Some of the gold washes over and escapes. Whereas, in my fancy, he is quicksilver raiding down a riffle. No grain of the metal stands much chance of eluding him. A powerful agent is the right word. It lights the reader's way, and makes it plain. A close approximation to it will answer, and much traveling is done in a well enough fashion by its help, but we do not welcome it, and applaud it, and rejoice in it as we do, when the right one blazes out on us. Whenever we come upon one of those intensely right words in a book, or a newspaper, the resulting effect is physical as well as spiritual, and electrically prompt. It tingles exquisitely around through the walls of the mouth and tastes as tart and crisp and good as the autumn butter that creams the sumac berry. One has no time to examine the word and vote upon its rank and standing. The automatic recognition of its supremacy is so immediate. There is a plenty of acceptable literature which deals largely in approximations, but it may be likened to a fine landscape seen through the rain. The right word would dismiss the rain, then you would see it better. It doesn't rain when Owls is at work. And where does he get the easy and effortless flow of his speech? And its cadenced and undulating rhythm? And its architectural felicities of construction, its graces of expression, its pemmican quality of compression, and all that? Born to him, no doubt. All in shining good order in the beginning, all extraordinary. And all just as shining, just as extraordinary today, after 40 years of diligent wear and tear and use. He passed his 40th year long and long ago, but I think his English of today is perfect English, I wish to say, can throw down the glove before his English of that antique time, and not be afraid. I will get back to the paper on Machiavelli now, and ask the reader to examine this passage from it which I append. I do not mean examine it in a bird's eye way, I mean search it, study it, and, of course, read it aloud. I may be wrong, still it is my conviction that one cannot get out of finely wrought literature all that is in it by reading it mutely. Mr. Dyer is rather of the opinion, first luminously suggested by Macaulay, that Machiavelli was in earnest, but must not be judged as a political moralist of our time and race would be judged. He thinks that Machiavelli was in earnest, as none but an idealist can be, and he is the first to imagine him an idealist immersed in realities, who involuntarily transmutes the events under his eye into something like the visionary issues of reverie. The Machiavelli whom he depicts does not cease to be politically a republican and socially a just man, because he holds up an atrocious despot like Caesar Borgia as a mirror for rulers. What Machiavelli beheld round him in Italy was a civic disorder in which there was oppression without statecraft, and revolt without patriotism. When a miscreant like Borgia appeared upon the scene, and reduced both tyrants and rebels to an apparent quiescence, he might very well seem to such a dreamer the savior of society whom a certain sort of dreamers are always looking for. Machiavelli was no less honest when he honored the diabolical force than Carlyle was when at different times he extolled the strong man who destroys liberty in creating order. But Carlyle has only just ceased to be mistaken for a reformer, while it is still Machiavelli's hard fate to be so trammeled in his material that his name stands for whatever is most malevolent and perfidious in human nature. You see how easy and flowing it is, how unvexed by ruggednesses, clumsinesses, broken meters, how simple and, so far as you or I can make out unstudied, how clear, how limpid, how understandable, how unconfused by cross-currents, eddies, undertows, how seemingly unadorned, yet is all adornment, like the lily of the valley, and how compressed, how compact, without a complacency signal hung out anywhere, to call attention to it. There are 23 lines in the quoted passage. After reading it several times aloud, one perceives that a good deal of matter is crowded into that small space. I think it is a model of compactness. When I take its materials apart, and work them over, and put them together in my way, I find I cannot crowd the result back into the same hole, there not being room enough. I find it a case of a woman packing a man's trunk. He can get the things out, but he can't ever get them back again. The proffered paragraph is a just and fair sample. The rest of the article is as compact as it is. There are no waste words. The sample is just in other ways. Limpid, fluent, graceful, and rhythmical as it is, it holds no superiority in these respects over the rest of the essay. Also, the choice phrasing noticeable in the sample is not lonely. There is a plenty of its kin distributed through the other paragraphs. This is claiming much, when that kin must face the challenge of a phrase like the one in the middle sentence. An idealist immersed in realities who involuntarily transmutes the events under his eye into something like the visionary issues of reverie. With 100 words to do it with, the literary artisan could catch that airy thought, untie it down, and reduce it to a concrete condition, visible, substantial, understandable and all right, like a cabbage. But the artist does it with 20, and the result is a flower. The quoted phrase, like 1,000 others, that have come from the same source, has the quality of certain scraps of verse which take hold of us, and stay in our memories. We do not understand why, at first. All the words being the right words, none of them is conspicuous, and so they all seem inconspicuous. Therefore we wonder what it is about them that makes their message take hold. The mossy marbles rest on the lips that he has pressed in their bloom, and the names he loved to hear have been carved for many a year on the tomb. It is like a dreamy strain of moving music, with no sharp notes in it. The words are all light words, and all the same size. We do not notice it at first. We get the effect, it goes straight home to us, but we do not know why. It is when the right words are conspicuous that they thunder. The glory that was Greece and the grandeur that was Rome. When I got back from Howells old to Howells young, I find him arranging and clustering English words well, but not any better than now. He is not more felicitous in concreting abstractions now than he was in translating then the visions of the eyes of flesh into words that reproduced their forms and colors. In Venetian streets they give the fallen snow no rest. It is at once shoveled into the canals by hundreds of half-naked. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.